It's a pleasure for me to give basically the first talk on the complete picture that we got exploring pion scattering matrices. And in this talk that I did in collaboration with Pedro and Joao Penadones, and also in the early stage with John Toledo, who's a postdoc here, I will show you some geography of this intricate parameter space where QCD seems to lie. So, when we started this project, basically, there has been already some paper in 1+1 dimension, then in 3+1 dimensions, bounding amplitudes. But what we wanted to do is to address directly the real problem that people dream to address, which is the QCD scattering matrix. So we consider pions because if you neglect electroweak interactions and you assume that the up and the quarks have the same mass, pions are stable particles. They're the lightest particles in the theory. So in my introduction, I will give you a brief summary of what pions are. I will describe our numerical setup, the conformal mapping that we use to deal with analyticity, some experimental data that we will use as a tool to model our ansatz, and then how the knowledge of chiral effective field theory it enables us to get some interesting feature. And I will basically do some geography and see future projects. So, I will give you an anti-historical picture, which is more CFT friendly. So imagine that you have in the ultraviolet gauge theory, particularly SU3, coupled to some fermionic matter in the SU2 times SU2 chiral representation. So what usually happens is that this theory goes through a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And the spontaneous symmetry breaking is leading by the chiral condensate, psi by psi, which is the order parameter for the transition. And in the ultraviolet, pions parameterize the coset space of the symmetry breaking pattern. In this case, this psi by psi condensate preserves this SU2 vector symmetry. And pions are basically SU2 matrices that transform in a non-trivial way under the global group. But this is not the end of the story, because the chiral symmetry is also explicitly broken by a mass term in the Lagrangian. But we know that when a symmetry is broken by a term which is at most quadratic in the fields, it's a soft breaking, so the word identities are preserved. And this is just a deformation that does not touch the realization of the symmetry. So the important point to understand is that pions are not only particles that are charged under some global group, which in this case would be a joint representation of SU2, which is okay, which can be isomorphic to SO3, but they also transform under a nonlinear realization of the global group. And what we will see is that this condition is loosely constraining, while imposing in a way that these particles are approximate Gostone bosons will be what will give us all the structures that we find in this parameter space.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yes,
please. SU2s, I forgot my lessons from master.
Yes.
The SU2 symmetry comes from where? The SU2 left and the SU2 right.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. So we imagine that we have two fermions, so only two fermions. So they, since they are massless at the very beginning, so they transform so the left and right components transform independently under this SU2 rotation of the two components.
But you also have your one baryon.
Sorry? I'm not considering invariant. Yeah, it's a symmetry. Well, in this case, it's yeah, it's conserved. Yeah.
And you also say, you said the born identities are preserved. The symmetry is broken.
The symmetry is broken by a soft term. So, yeah, so the analogous is word identities in gauge theories. So imagine that you do perturbation theory in gauge theory, and you want to fix the gauge to do perturbation theory, right? The gauge fixing term is usually at most quadratic in the fields, such that the only effect that you can get is a shift in the two-point functions, but all the higher point functions will preserve the word identities.
Maybe the question was that you're considering only two flavors.
Right. Sorry. Okay.
That's where the two comes from.
I mean, I thought the word identity would just simply get another term. It would be modified.
Yeah. Yeah, but the higher point, the word identities for the two-point functions, but for the higher point functions, they will not be modified. But okay. So okay. So the first thing that we want to implement in our setup is the fact that these particles charged under a global symmetry. So this is very easy to do, and if you imagine that you are scattering this particle, in the initial state they will have some indices A and B, in the final state some indices C and D. The amplitude will be depend on these four indices, and you can build up the three independent tensor structures, which are expressed in terms of delta, and these three functions have this symmetry under T and U, which is basically reflects the fact that this delta function in the C and D indices, which are the indices of the external of the final particles, is symmetric. So this is a crossing symmetric. This is a base in which crossing symmetry is manifest. But to impose unitarity, we need to go to a basis which is more experimental friendly. And so if you imagine that your particles, if you imagine scattering in the center of mass frame, you can understand that the only two independent variables are the energy in which the particles scatter and the angle that they are deflected. So indeed, the two variables independent can be taken just to be S and T, and U, which helps to realize the full crossing, it's just related to S and T by the on-shell condition. This unitarity basis, so in what we call unitarity basis, the amplitude can be expanded in terms of reducible representations of the ON global group, global symmetry. And P0 is, as you can imagine, a projection on the singlet, on the symmetric representation, and on the anti-symmetric representation. And then you can further expand the single amplitude in a definite rep into partial waves. So I can, as you can see here, there are some Legendre polynomials which depend on the angle. And here we will have this function SL, which are the partial S matrices projecting in different states with different angular momentum. So now, before writing the ansatz for this function, as these functions A's, which are our building blocks, we need to have some fast look on the experimental data, because we want to know, for example, if there are bound states or if there are resonances in our theory. So we can look at the phase shifts, the experimental one, that looks kind of messy, but they are not difficult to describe. So what is in this plot is basically the phase shift of the partial S matrix in some angular momentum channel and isospin channel. So the easier to understand are these bottom ones, where here there is the phase shift in the antisymmetric representation in spin one. And you can see very clearly that there is some arctan shape. And this arctan shape around a mass which is like 770 pass through pi over 2. This is usually the signature how resonances show up in phase shifts. So the S matrix, S shift, they pass pi to pi over 2 and zap to pi. The same kind of shape, you can see it in the spin 2, in the spin 2 channel, and I spin 0. So also here you see that there is another particle because the phase shift passed to pi over 2. So it's funny that the spin 1 and spin 2 are kind of simple to describe, but the spin 0 are messier, as you can see. Here, for example, this is the symmetric channel, and the amplitude is very small. The phase shift is very small, goes up to 30 degrees, does not pass through pi over 2, it's like negative. And we will understand why this is so.
So these are degrees.
Degrees, yeah. Experimental likes degree. In the, yeah, so the last channel that it's also important is the spin zero, so spin zero, the scalar channel. And here the situation is much messier. Actually, people for years didn't know if this particle was there or not. This is the so-called sigma. It does not clearly show up as an arctan shape in these shifts, but show up as a mountain, and it's people say it's far in the complex plane, and it's not that clear. And then for months we thought that this jump was due to the KK-bar threshold, but actually it's due to another resonance, and so on. So at some point the pattern becomes very messy, but the what I want to just that you remember that there is a resonance in the spin 1, antisymmetric channel, one in the spin 2, but we will not talk about this one, and there is probably another resonance in the spin 0, singlet channel. So now that we learned there are no bound states, but only resonance, we can write our ansatz. So, but before writing our ansatz, which is already spoiled here, we need to implement the analyticity assumption, basically extending the three Mandelson variables to a space, which is basically C3 minus the cuts. So we assume some sort of maximum analyticity in this amplitude. And one can imagine to expand this amplitude in polynomials, in STNU, but if you do so, what will happen is that your radius of convergence will be bounded by 4, because it's the first branch point. So what we basically do is just do a change of variables using these magic row variables, thanks, Matthijs. And which basically foliate the complex plane in this way. So you can see they start to foliate as a circles, and they basically go in a smart way around the cut, avoiding it. Sorry? So Z0 actually is a parameter that you can choose. So in principle, you could move these row variables. And in particular, if Z0 is less than 4 and real, automatically this expansion is real analytic. Real analytic means that it's real on the real axis and then takes complex conjugate values on complex conjugate points in the complex plane. So in terms of these row variables, now mapping our three-dimensional complex plane into this variable, we can write a simple ansatz as a Taylor expansion. And we will impose directly the symmetry in TNU. So we'll have like two sets of coefficients, which will be the coefficients of our optimization problem. And then multiplied by polynomial, which are symmetric in TNU. And as you can see, there are only polynomial in two of the three Mandelson variables appearing, because these ansatz, these analytic extensions, it's not unique. It's not unique because you on the physical section, the physical section is the section where the on-shell condition is satisfied, which means that U is 4 minus S minus T. On this section will be invariant if you basically, it will be invariant up to polynomials in this constraint, 4 minus S minus T. So in a sense, this is a way to fix this gauge that we have. That's why. And it's basically equivalent to the Mandelstam representation. Now, how we in practice implement the numerics? So, as I was telling you, the unitarity condition is on the partial S matrices, and the partial S matrices are related to the amplitude under a linear operation, basically. So you multiply by the phase space factor, you integrate over the Legendre polynomials, and these are, this is the linear operation in the ansatz coefficients, those A and B that are also in the blackboard in red. We will substitute infinity in our sum with some n max, which will be our cutoff, our Taylor expansion. And we will impose unitarity for each point, for each spin, and for each reducible representation in this way. Of course, for numerical purposes, we just bound up to some L max. And we choose some grid of points that in the row variables that map the cut to the upper boundary of the disk, they can look like in this way. So they are more concentrated in zero, at infinity, in order to avoid the Gibbs phenomenon, in a sense. And our bootstrap problem will always be formulated as a maximization or minimization of a linear target in the ansatz coefficients given this constraint. This will be our bootstrap problem. Now, before going to the numerics, I mentioned that there are resonances. Let's see how resonances can be embedded in this formalism. So, as you remember, bound states are basically correspond to stable particles and they are real poles. In particular, they are poles, sub-threshold poles between, in this case, 0 and 4, because I'm imagining that t is 0 and this is the complex plane in the S variable. There are two green poles because of crossing symmetry. But resonances, which correspond to unstable particles, we expect they have some complex mass. So in principle, we would expect they are poles in the complex plane, complex poles. But this cannot be because poles for complex values would violate causality. And causality is basically related to analyticity. So the fact that the function has to be analytic in all the upper half plane or lower half plane. So what the common wisdom is to imagine that these resonances are hidden behind the cut. So they are hidden behind the cut. And the question that one can ask is that what is the effect of these poles hidden on the physical sheet? And one can understand what happens by using unitarity and analyticity. So when the scattering is elastic, so in all the regime where the scattering is elastic, one can use unitarity and real analyticity to write such a relation. Such a relation is saying that the S matrix in one point on the physical sheet is related to the S matrix on the same point on the second sheet by this relation. So this means that if you have a pole on the second sheet, you will have a zero in the physical sheet. So we will look for or impose resonances as zeros in the S matrix in the physical sheet using this condition. Now, as I told you in the introduction, we implemented the global symmetry on the external variables. We saw that there are no bound states, you wrote an ansatz, you understand how to deal with the resonances, but I haven't told you anything about the nonlinear realization of the symmetry. And some hints about this linear realization comes from effective field theory. So from we can consider chiral perturbation theory at leading order. So what is chiral perturbation theory? Is the effective field theory built up by those matrices in the coset space that I introduced at the beginning. So they're SU2 matrices that transform under left-right conjugate. So, and the lowest order Lagrangian that you can write contains two derivatives. And since of the mass deformations will contain also some mass square term. There is F square for the it's a dimensionful parameter, and 4 is such that when you expand, you get a canonical normalized Lagrangian for the fluctuations phi. So we can do this expansion. You will get the free Lagrangian plus some interaction. And one can check that this Lagrangian is easily invariant under the unbroken part of the chiral group, but it's realized in a complicated way. But the full group is realized in a complicated way, as we expect from a theory with spontaneous symmetry breaking. So we can compute the three-level amplitude using these vertices, and the answer is particularly simple. The answer is given, again, in terms of those independent tensor structures that I introduced at the beginning, and they are on the blackboard, first formula. And as you can see, in front of this structure, you get a function which is symmetric in T and U, like very trivially. And then higher order corrections will be of order P to the fourth, M to the fourth, or M squared pi squared, as expected from an expansion in the theory. And the nonlinear realization of the symmetry. So in the when the particles are massless, here M is zero, this is just S over F squared, T over F squared, U over F squared. And you see that when S equals T equals U, the amplitude vanishes. And this is basically how the nonlinear realization appears in amplitudes, appears as soft theorems. Of course, when the theory is deformed by mass, this is more complicated, and on shell, it's particularly complicated. But we can look at three-level, at the three-level answer. So if you compute the three-level answer, you will see that if you compute the amplitude in the spin zero singlet, it takes this very simple form. It's like linear in S. And it contains a zero at 1/2 m squared. The same happens for the symmetric channel amplitude. It has a zero at 2 m squared. Again, it's linear. Well, they are all linear. And the amplitude in the symmetric channel will have a zero in S1 over F4 m squared. This zero here, it's not very interesting because it's exact at all orders, because it's just due to symmetry. Basically, you have bosonic particle that you want to put in anti-symmetric representation. The only way to do it is like to give them some momentum. So the amplitude has to vanish at threshold, cannot be a constant. This is the reason why this does not move going to higher loops. While these zeros will move, but this is the three-level answer. So what we learn is that it's true that the theory is explicitly broken, but still, if you look at the amplitudes in the lowest spin in the singlet symmetric channel, you will have some zeros. So be careful now, because these zeros are not zero in the S matrices like resonances. These are zeros in the amplitude. And zeros in the amplitude means that at those points, the partial S matrices are one. So it's some sort of weak coupling conditions. While resonance is very strong conditions because puts the S matrix to zero. So the final parameters, the other most important actors in this game that we are going to play are the scattering lengths, which basically are the expansion of the amplitude at threshold. So we go at S equals 4, we start to expand the amplitude, and basically by the fact that you have these Legendre polynomials, you expect that this expansion starts with the k to 2l, etc. So what is k? K is the center of mass momentum. It's like square root over s minus 4, the center of mass momentum. So the leading constant is what is called scattering lengths, while the blue constants are what are called effective ranges or scattering slopes. Depends on how you look at them. And if you want some physical meaning for this scattering length, they either represent the strength of the interaction at threshold, or they can be related also to the time delay. So in a sense, you can imagine that if you send a wave against the scattering center, if the interaction is attractive, the wave will be delayed more before being re-emitted, let's say. Well, if the scattering length is negative, the time delay is negative, but of course it's bounded, otherwise you would violate causality. And just to give you an example, these are the values claimed by people for QCD. What I just want to point out is that in the singlet channel is positive, in the symmetric channel is negative, and in the antisymmetric channel is positive. And if you remember the plot about the experimental data, you could remember that the phase shift in the a single channel, symmetric channel, anti-symmetric channel were showing resonances because the interaction is attractive and the scattering lengths are positive. While in the symmetric channel, the phase was negative and there were no resonances because the interaction is repulsive.
These things are experimental data or?
So actually we received a kind of complaint about this. So these are like, it's all that are experimental data, but you do not really scatter pions because you cannot. So what you do is that you extract data on pion-pion scattering using some theoretical layer. You know, so you have some other data, then you use them as input, and then you extract these values. So people complain saying, yeah, they are not really experimental, but they are, you know, using some dispersion relations. So they are like a combination of the some data plus some theoretical tool.
Sorry for the ignorant question.
No, please.
These kind of things you cannot do like from lattice.
So from lattice is you can, but it's very hard to go to physical masses because you know, as the mass becomes light in the lattice, you need to discretize the Dirac operator, which is the kinetic term, and then you have to invert it to get the propagators. So the problem is that when the mass is very small, this matrix becomes more singular because the eigenvalues are smaller, and it's difficult to invert. So it's very difficult to go to physical masses for the lattice. But of course, there are estimates like with the pions with a higher mass, which are expressed in many parameters. I still have no idea how to convert those formulas, but they give you some expression. So before going to the plots, let's do some summary. So what we said? We said that we implement crossing symmetry automatically in our ansatz, choosing some tensorial representation. We implemented Mandelstam analyticity, real analyticity in these building blocks using these magic row variables. And then we are going to check unitarity, spin per spin, representation per representation. And this will become a semi-definite constraint in our problem. And the parameters of the game are this expansion parameters at threshold, the scattering length, the effective ranges, the chiral zeros in the amplitude, and the resonances. These are the parameters that we are going to play. So the first game that we play is to not input anything and just consider the minimum values that the scattering length can take. So they're unbounded from above, because as I told you before, if you think about scattering length as time delays, time delay can be arbitrarily large. There's no problem for that, but they are bounded from below because otherwise you would violate causality. The wave cannot be re-emitted too much before the... So there is some bound. That's the only thing I want to say. And as you can see from this figure, the internal part is what is allowed and the external is what is excluded. And the QCD values for these three scattering lengths that I showed in the table before happens to be well inside this surface. And this is what we expect because in this first game, we didn't input anything about the nonlinear realization of the global chiral symmetry. We just said that these particles have like some SO3 global charge and that's what you get. So in principle, you could explore this bound. You could ask what is the S matrices that lie on this extremal surface, but they do not resemble QCD. They show resonances in other channels. Okay. So the first, the second thing that we want to do is to impose these chiral zeros then. The problem is that, as I also told you, we can learn where these chiral zeros are at tree level, but they get loop corrections. So actually, we don't really know where they are, because these loop corrections depend on some low energy constants that people need to fit from data. It's very hard. So what we do is to play a different kind of game. Let's say that we impose a chiral zero in the singlet channel. We impose the raw resonance. So we impose a resonance, which is a very strong condition. And we maximize or minimize the amplitude in the symmetric channel between 0 and 4. So again, we fix the 0 and the singlet channel, the rho resonance, and then we look at the maximum minimum in another channel. What you get is what is shown in this figure. The blue line is the, this is schematically shown, it's not a real plot, but this is what happens. The blue line is the boundary for the, well, the blue line is due to the maximum value, this blue line for the minimum, and all the amplitudes are contained in this strip. And there is some important phenomenon that happens, and is that there is a region where the maximum value of the amplitude in this channel is negative. This means that I cannot impose at the same time a zero in the singlet channel and a zero in the symmetric channel, as we learned from chiral perturbation theory. So there is this exclusion region that we will call lake, as you will see from the next plot. But let me say one more thing, which is the maximum value of the amplitude in each point is unique because the constraints are convex, so the optimization problem converges to a unique solution. But in principle, there can be different amplitude contained in this strip that can have the same zero. But if you go to the boundary that is defined between the intersection of the maximum curve with the S2 axis, in this point, you will have a unique amplitude whose maximum is the zero. So this is the unique amplitude that's a zero at this point. So now we can vary S0, which is our handle. So we fix S0 in a different point in the singlet channel. And what we get is what we call the pion lake. So the outside region is the allowed region for this zero. So S0 and S2 are the value of the zero in the singlet channel, symmetric channel. Or the values outside the lake are allowed, the values in the white region inside are excluded. And it's very interesting to notice that the three-level chiral perturbation theory point is excluded. So it means that in some sense, when you introduce the resonance as a deformation, this is a very strong deformation, and the most naive answer for the amplitude, it's not allowed anymore. It's excluded. And the boundary of this lake, in some sense, represent the theories which are most free, because they are closer to the three-level point, given the presence of a resonance. So we can wonder, for example, if the scattering length that you can measure looking at the S matrices lying on the shore of this lake have any resemblance to the ones of QCD. And this is shown, well, this is spoiled here, but is shown in the next plot, where basically now we go around this lake. So the different colors, correspond to some gradient as you move around the lake. And as you can see, there are three points that you could call special already from the profile of the lake, which are these A, B, and C. But then if you look at the scattering lengths that you measure as you move around, you see that the C point is kind of smooth, though it looks like tip. But the A and B point are real kinks in this parameter space. And it's nice to notice that there is this A kink, which is also represented here, which is very close to both the three-level point and to the QCD point. So the ellipsoid here is where the experimental values are contained. So for example, a question that one can ask is that how this theory looks like, and in general, what happens to this kink. But just to give you an idea, the theory in this, at this kink here, since as the right sign for the scattering length, resembles in a sense QCD, while the theory at the kink B has opposite scattering length. So it means that, for example, the singlet channel is repulsive instead of being attractive, so you have resonances, you have the resonance pattern that show up in another channel, let's say. So it looks very different. But now, before going, before moving forward, we want to play another game. So from the lake, apart learning that there are some kings, so the parameter space shows some structure, we saw that the space of zero is very large. So there is all the region outside the lake that is allowed for these zeros. So what one can ask is, for example, if we imagine that we introduce more constraints, so it means that we impose the raw resonance, but maybe we impose also some inequalities on the scattering lens, like the experimental inequalities. What will happen to the lake? So you can expect that if you start to impose more constraints, the lake eventually will basically flood the plane, and maybe it will become a peninsula. That's what we thought. And actually, to probe this, we play the same game as before. So we fix the zero in the singlet channel as an handle. And then we look for the maximum and minimum of the amplitude in the symmetric channel, in the other channel. And then you can see is that there is a region where the maximum, there is a big region where the maximum is negative and a big region where the maximum is positive. There is only one tiny region where they are positive and negative, so where it can be a zero. So what was before a lake now became something that resembles more an island or a peninsula. This very small region, which is the green one, which is the region that allows you to put a zero, a chiral zero. So as you move as zero now, as you start to move this handle on all the line between zero and four, you will get this kind of profile. And this looked like a peninsula for us. And if you basically zoom in at the tip of this peninsula, you see that touches the lake, but eventually at some point departs from the lake. So it means that that king that we found, for example, around the lake, it's true that it's compatible with QCD, but it's a kind of different theory, because a theory that has the scattering land in the same range that where the scattering lands for QCD are, have zeros which are confined in a smaller region. So one can ask, for example, what happens to the theories as you move on the boundary of this peninsula? This is what we asked next. So what we got is that. So now we fixed a lot of things. We fixed the row, we fixed the inequalities on the scattering lens. But we can, for example, look at the other two quantities, which are not in the blackboard, but that were the effective ranges. So you can measure these effective ranges, which are the derivative of the amplitude, basically, some slope, as you move around the peninsula. And as you see, as you approach the tip, this is done for our highest n max, which is n max equal 20, just to give you an idea. But as you move around this peninsula, you go to the tip, it seems that increasing n max, which are the gray curves, our numerics approaches more the ellipses where the experimental values lie. Moreover, if we look at our ansatz contains also zeros in the singlet channel amplitude, in the singlet channel S matrix, that we would like to interpret as the sigma resonance. So we can measure the position of these zeros, this zero, and compare it with the experiments. Now, the experiments here are not that constraining, because the sigma, as I told you, since it's not very clear from the plot, they cannot determine it very well. So it's like in the complex plane, this is its real part, imaginary part with a big error. But anyway, as we approach to the tip of the peninsula, the value for the complex mass of this particle seems to lie inside the experimental constraints. So it's compatible and we are happy. But now, before going to the very last part, let's do some summary. So we start to do this exploration of this putting these resonances, these linear inequalities, to learn something on the position of these zeros that, as I told you, are only that there can that we cannot know in, exactly in perturbation theory. So from the just imposing the row, we learn that there is an exclusion lake where the three level point is excluded, and there is an A kink, so some special point which is particularly close to the QCD one. And then we also learned that if in addition we impose the Rose essence plus scattering lens, we get a peninsula. So one can choose, like we could fix directly these zeros at this point or at the tip of the peninsula. So we chose to fix these zeros to be at the tip of the peninsula. And we fix this zero, so as zero to this point in the single channel, as two in this point on the symmetric channel. And what we do is to basically redo the same optimization problem that we did at the beginning. So imposing only these zeros and minimize the scattering lens. So what happens now to that 3D surface? It happens that this 3D surface gets more structure. In particular, there are like two three-dimensional cusps, one at the free theory, one and some theory that we still don't know how it looks like actually. And between the two cusps, there is an edge. Now, the values for the scattering lens for QCD seems to lie on this edge that connects these two three-dimensional kinks. But I will not show you these 3D figures because we don't know still how to plot it very well because it's complicated, but I can show you a section. So I can cut this three-dimensional surface, fixing the scattering lens in the singlet channel, and what it happens is that there is a kink. So the kink shows up in the other scattering lens in the symmetric channel and anti-symmetric channel. So imagine, there is no reason why there should be a kink, and there is no reason why this kink should be at the QCD point. But at the same time, we know that we fixed these chiral zeros, which are related to the non-linearization of the global symmetry. So in sense, it seems that this global realization of the global symmetry, plus the fact that we fix one parameter, is powerful enough to select for us a theory at the kink that has the scattering values parameter, which are very close to the experimental ones. And then we can ask, but what about the other parameters in the theory? What about the effective ranges? What about the mass of the resonance, etc.? So we try to do it, and remarkably for us, they all show a kink. So if you plot, for example, the effective range of the slope of the amplitude, if you want, as a function of the scattering length in the antisymmetric channel, this A11, you see that shows a kink, and the kink is like compatible with experimental values. Then you can do the same for the slope in the singlet channel, and as well, it's close to the experimental value. Then one can ask, okay, but what about the resonances? So we look for zeros. We look for zero in the singlet channel. And again, well, here it's not much, but it's compatible with experimental values. It shows up in these positions. And then there are other zeros that emerge. So if we look, for example, in the spin one amplitude, we see that there is another zero emerging. Now, the zero that emerges does not really match the experimental row position. But this is, but we are going to improve this point. So this does not match, but you can imagine that you can move this chiral zeros and this zero position is correlated to where you fix these other conditions. So this can be improved. But the important point is that it seems there is a spectrum emerging. There is a spin zero, a spin one, and maybe if you improve the numerics, there will be a spin two emerge. So, my conclusion. So as I told you, we started this exploration of 3D plus one dimensional S matrices, which is very complicated. And what we learned is that if you do not impose some more condition like this other zero conditions, the space of parameters does not show many structures. But as you impose this chirality, the space shows cusps, and you can compare with the data. So what we are going to do next is basically to study, for example, different symmetry breaking patterns, for example, for massless particles in 1+1 dimensions. And we can, again, ask if there are kinks. And since numerics in 1+1 dimensions is much easier, we can expect to get more spectacular results, maybe. Or then we can ask the same problem for massless pions in 3+1 and study this apparent regization that starts to appear. Because I told you there are these resonances that appear. But the reason why they are so difficult to study numerically is because the mass of the pion is very different from the QCD, it's very far from the QCD scale. They are almost massless, while the first resonances, like the row that wants to appear at much higher energies. So working with massless pions would allow us to tune some other scale and see if these resonances appear like in easier positions where you can study and see if they regize. Then there is some APH project that we can try to study, for example, to adapt our ansatz for experimental data. This would be a gift to experimentalists that we give them. And then try some precision physics test, for example, try smarter way to impose this chirality and see if we can put bounds or better bounds on these two energy parameters. And maybe, which is like
for us, like
use a QCD as a window to understand how much this S-matrix can be predictable, which is the predictability power of this S-matrix, and maybe try to apply it to other theories. And I don't know, that's the dream. OK, thanks.
So can you say again what was the constraint that allowed you to go from the lake to the peninsula?
Yeah. So as I showed you in this picture, as you go around the lake, you see that the scattering lengths follow an orbit in this space. So what we do for the peninsula is just that we constrain the scattering length to be inside some parallelepiped, very small parallelepiped around the experimental data. So it's that these are like a freedom that you have. We fix this plot to some point, which is this ellipsoid, which is also there. And then you get the peninsula, basically. And actually, it's like, What can be funny to study is that, for example, relax these constraints and see how the lake flowed the space of zeros and becomes the peninsula, so which is like the part that flowed before and how it deforms. It would be nice.
So you have this condition between the resonance and the pole. So it seems that the derivative close to the pole should tell you something about the strength of the pion-pion row coupling. Did you use this?
No.
Did you work? Is this experimentally measurable?
So there are some experimental estimates, actually. So it's something that... So for the sigma, it's kind of the sigma is not well known. So it's a coupling that has large errors. But for example, for draw, it's very well measured. Then we could measure the residue or the slope at 0 in our ansatz and compare it with the experiments when we get some reasonable values for the vector resonance.
More questions? Andrea? If not, let's thank the speaker again.
Okay. Thanks.